Yeah, so this is, I'm really hoping this is gonna be very informal. I'll try to give you a sense of where my models fit into the overall field and some of the recent results, but really try to concentrate in the end and spend a significant amount of time of projects that I've started and would love help and ideas and thoughts about pushing forward. So I'll start with that. So the first thing I want to impress on you is that this field is quite, or this project is quite complicated, and it really involves two separate aspects. One is the radiation and one is the hydrodynamics. And there's a number of groups that are working on this, many are in the room, but there's also going to be many more people coming out, I think, over the next few years working on this thing. And the question is, how do you deal with the hydrodynamics and how do you deal with the radiation? And I kind of like to think of, this is how I think of categorizing these is how do you, what do you choose for those two things? And so, in the kind of a for the dynamical methods in a hierarchical list, I guess you might say, you could walk down and you can and I think you'll talk a little bit more about the details, and perhaps if people are interested, we can have a breakout session and look at exactly how to derive all these things. I don't think there's any time to do that right now, but. The first step is to kind of take an equivalent barotropic or a 2D model, so you have a longitude and latitude grid, but you average over the vertical. The next step is to take the primitive equations, which are actually, you do resolve the vertical, but you assume, instead of solving the full vertical momentum equation, you assume hydrostatic equilibrium. The next would be a Navier-Stokes equation in 2D. Not sure where that fits in, but there's been some simulations of that. And then finally, to solve the full Navier-Stokes equation in 3D.
And you want to define Navier-Stokes?
I'll show the Navier-Stokes equations in a sec, since that's what I'm doing.
So it's equations of hydrodynamics.
Yes. Fully compressible, viscous, three-dimensional. Yes, right. Good point. So for the radiation transfer, there's again a number of methods have been used. Relaxation methods, where you assume some sort of profile. There's been various ways in doing this. Things that vary. Obviously, the radiation profile for these locked planets will vary in longitude and latitude, but also in depth. So you assume some sort of profile, some sort of radio equilibrium profile, and as the fluid advects energy here and there, you relax back towards that at some time scale which you specify. There's an approach that you've used in the past, which is a one-temperature approximation. So you assume that the radiation and the fluid are both can be described as a single temperature, and then use flux-limited radiative diffusion, which has been used in a wide range of fields. And again, we can go into that later if you'd like. And then the second thing, which some of the results I'll show you today, which is actually decoupling the radiative and the thermal components. So you have a temperature, radiation temperature, and a gas temperature. And then finally, another recent development has been actually coupling the fluid dynamics to real one-dimensional radiative transfer codes. One note on this is this is only one-dimensional radiation transfer. Radiation can only go up and down. So it doesn't neglect things on going sideways.
But one can do better than that.
Right. No, this is not, neither of these things, well, are
so Ian, I can say something about the last point.
Yeah.
I think it's a bit unfair the way you phrase it. The point is that radiation, it goes in all directions, especially in the thermal part of the spectrum. But you can show that you can do two-stream approximations with the problem, having only two slanted streams. And that is pretty accurate.
That's accurate to get the temperature thermal profile, not necessarily the emission off the planet.
Yeah, the spectral is another issue, but so it's not, it does account for the fact that the radiation goes in all directions using some approximate.
Okay,
right. It's not that
people, there's a prominence of this approach in the Earth's climate.
It's what people do for the Earth, and it works
very
well.
Yeah, right, so, absolutely.
And where they're focused not on taking a picture of the Earth, but on trying to get the climate of the Earth. And that's the in-situ profiles of temperature, density, and pressure, and this sort of thing, and they're very true.
Right. Okay, so what so far, I mean, again, this is a computationally difficult problem. So far what people have done is pick one, and one choice for hydrodynamics, one choice for radiation, usually necessarily compromising on one or the other for in interest of computational power and getting the simulation done in a reasonable amount of time. So what I've done is I've taken the 3D Navier, this is the latest stuff that I'll show today, is the 3D Navier-Stokes equations, coupled to a flux-limited diffusion, where I've decoupled the thermal and radiative components. So this is, again, the full fluid equation. You know, I think we all know what all these terms are. But just to point out that I am now including the viscous terms down here. So.
But you're putting in your own viscosity.
For a set viscosity at the moment, but that is something, of course, that can change. For a single viscosity, a constant viscosity,
right.
Constant isotropic viscosity.
That can be very ambiguous, though.
Absolutely. Yes, yeah, so I think that's going to be an overarching theme with these models, is that there's, of course, all these parameters can be tweaked. So, yes, take all the grain of salt, yes. This is a prescription for flux limited. Again, I can go into it.
The come on decoupled means that you've got two temperatures?
Yeah, so that's the energy equation down here. So this is the fluid. This is just three-dimensional momentum equation, mass equation. This is the flux, and now we're looking at this would be the radiation temperature. And this is the flux limiter, which is a way of approximating between optically thin and optically thick gas. And
where that go? Okay.
And
where that thing starts at a third.
So yeah, so this becomes in the limits in the limits of optically thin, it comes CE, and the optically thick, it becomes the standard diffusion equation.
So when you call the radiation temperature, I can think of that as a deviation from blackbody.
Yes.
That's basically
right. So this is then here are the two energy equations. So you'd have the radiation energy equation and the thermal energy equation. So just starting with let's start with the thermal. It's probably more familiar.
Sure, it's not a good thing. There's nothing about spectral. Just the effect of temperature of radiation is different.
The deviation from.
But when you're optically thick, that goes away. So that's the way I wanted to.
That's fine, but it's a two-temperature approach where you assume the energy density. You're actually hyping for the energy density of the radiation,
right.
And you can connect it to a temperature, which you might do for opacity purposes.
Right.
But there's an ambiguity there right from the get-go, but you don't say that the temperature that you would use for the radiation is the same as the temperature of the gas.
That's what it's.
So there is some liberation. There is some extra degree of freedom, which is useful.
This so, on this chart where it says T for opacity.
Here. Yeah, I'll get to that.
Okay.
I know what you're asking. very good. No, that's a good question. Okay, so thermal energy, of course, you have advection, compressional, and then what you have here is an exchange between the gas and the radiation, of course. So you have the same term in this equation, opposite sign. You have a viscous heating down here in the end. And then you have a term here which is essentially derived from assuming there are two channels, an optical channel and an infrared channel. But since you don't, you assume that the gas isn't going to emit in the optical, you can solve it analytically and just write down it as a source term, where you have some flux that's coming in and it's going to be attenuated
it's
by.
It's perfectly reasonable, of course, but at high enough atmospheric temperatures, it's going to emit the optical too.
Yes, that's true. Absolutely.
And there's some data that seems to imply that there are other systems that are doing that.
Well, so this method can be generalized to as many streams as you want, to some extent, but. The radiation, is now here as this div dot f, which is proportional here. So as you mentioned, there are actually three opacities in these equations. So you have a Rosslyn opacity. It's evaluated the local temperature and pressure. Planck, same thing. And then you have this stellar or absorption opacity, where you're evaluating this. So these are all gray. And I think I like the Kristen said it's a double gray double gray approximation. So these are all gray opacities, but when you calculate this, right? Okay. When you calculate this, these opacities, you use a different blackbody. So here's just a quick example of this. So this is an example of opacity as a function of here wave number. But so it's very detailed spectrum, so on and so forth. And so you're forming some sort of gray quantity like this, and obviously you're going to get a very different answer, or somewhat, depending on where you are, different answers if in this function that you're averaging over is the stellar blackbody or the local blackbody. And so the ratio of doing it with this versus this varies as a function of temperature and pressure and varies everywhere in the atmosphere. And so and this was actually pointed out by Houbini and Burroughs and in years ago, I don't know, when 2003, that's what it was. And then really has come to the forefront with the observations of inversions in these planets. So I'll talk a little bit about that later. But that's
rat and say the putative observations of inversions. heard you.
I'm convinced.
Yes, good point. I don't have a timer. Anybody have a watch?
11:10, yeah.
Okay. So just to kind of set the stage.
We're in 10 minutes.
faster. No, that's faster. That's good. All right, so, okay, thanks. Okay, so just to set the stage here, most of these simulations are of a 209458-like planet, so a tidally synchronized planet, spin-synchronized planet, rotation, orbital period of 3.5 days. Its stellar temperature is 6,100 Kelvin.
Dollars.
Isn't that what we get when we... okay, so this is a fold-out of the photosphere. The equator runs through the middle here. This is the... we're staring directly at the night side. The day side wraps around, of course. And so this is the temperature ranging from 500 to 1,400 degrees, again, at the kind of a gray photosphere. And so you can see...
this is the pressure level, the level of the tau equals something.
Tau equals 1 based on that gray photosphere.
Surfaces, you get different...
right, times. And that will come at the end. yes, so the idea is, obviously, hot day side, night, cold night side, you drive fluid flow. There is rotation, you can see the formation of several jets, jet-like structures. In the velocity plot.
Can you say again which surface we're looking at?
The photosphere, or this gray photosphere.
What's the difference between the previous slide and this slide?
Oh, the same thing. So they're the same location, but these are velocities, and this is temperature.
No,
what are the vectors?
This is also velocity. These are velocity vectors.
The vector fields are different between plots. I'm probably not seeing it correct.
This is IDL vectors. I hate IDL vectors.
They don't look like the same.
Yeah, you're right. They don't. It could be different times. Yeah. Sorry.
So this isn't relaxed.
Right. And we'll get to that. This particular simulation does have variability. But anyway, this is you can see the structure of the jets, where material flowing eastward seems to be funneled towards the equator, while material moving westward is pushed towards the poles. And I think that this is still an open question exactly why. You get three jets. I've suggested that, I think it's been suggested in the past, that it has to do with the Coriolis. There is an asymmetry based on the Coriolis force. It's weak. It's only 3 days, but it could be due to that. The other thing I want to point out is the sound speed is about 3 kilometers a second. So these are supersonic flows, which is, you know, plus or minus four kilometers a second. This is 3D, but this is just a 2D plot of the 3D simulations.
These are just horizontal velocities. There's no velocity up and down.
This is the total speed, but in the color. Well, I mean, yeah. So that's all you're seeing. There is a radial component when you're calculating this, but it's not. Yeah, it's swamped by.
What kind of optical depth can you calculate? I understand
it's
some
optical depth equals 1, but
it's
a plonk. Yeah.
We're using the infrared plonk.
Right. And so, yeah, like I'll get to later, I now have the capability to make these in different wave bands, but haven't finished that project yet. So that's one thing for the future. But
how deep does the gravitational zone go?
Yes. So I think the next one shows the pressure temperature profile. So this is temperature versus pressure. So this is getting up towards several hundred thousand bars out to 10 to the minus 4.
To 1,000.
Yeah, several hundred. That's 100. So you can see an interior adiabat coming out. And so everybody is, it's very spherically symmetric in the interior. You come out, there's some sort of dip here that's actually associated with flow returning back to the day side. It's flow that is cooling, subducting, and going down to the night side. You can see it's somewhat cooler here, for example, than at different latitudes. I'm sorry, I usually have a wheel that shows this direction here, but the red is the substellar point. This is the antistellar point, and it goes all the way around the planet. So again, I want to highlight this inversion. I think probably we all understand, we've heard it enough about it now that we understand it, but there's two inversions here. There's one in the upper atmosphere, and there's one in the lower atmosphere. And the first one in the upper atmosphere, I think, is probably what we're seeing, the main effect of what people claim are they're seeing in the spectra. And again, there's debate about this. I heard somebody say that. Groan.
Do you have the physics in there necessary to get the requisite temperatures in the upper atmosphere to explain?
So this particular model right here is not hot enough.
Right. I just want to make that point.
Yes.
But Ian, you were going to say that there is an inversion in infrared that's purely dynamical?
Yeah, so this is dynamical. So these dots here are, for example, the infrared photosphere. The optical photosphere is deeper down here. And then this would be isothermal were it not for the dynamics. And so this is some models of showing some spectra and associated pressure temperature profile, unfortunately flipped, but I think you guys can figure that out. Of various of models without, so this black one was without an temperature inversion, so and then ones with a temperature inversion. And these are models by Adam. He controls it basically by adding this extra absorber, some species at altitude that is absorbing.
There's something there that we don't know, and we don't know what it is that is giving these high temperatures.
Right. And there's a number of ideas about what it is, but none of them are yet confirmed or.
So you're saying that flat plateau is smoothed out by your dynamics?
Well, I'm saying that, well, okay, and so let me just finish up for everyone else here. This region here would be, again, a plateau, but he's added in an artificial sink of energy on the day side, which is supposed to mimic the dynamics, which is causing this dip here. And in order to explain all the data points, you need actually both inversions. And you see this IRAC point is actually probing, IRAC 1 is probing in this lower region.
We're doing very artificially.
So yeah, your computational zone goes well deep into the convection zone.
Yeah.
You have to do something special there?
In convection?
Yeah, in the convection.
Not in principle. And that's actually one of my slides in the end, is I'd like to understand that a little bit more, the interaction between that. And there are simulations where you see convection occurring down there, and what exactly its role is.
In your equation, you capture that.
Well, yeah, the full fluid, yeah, right.
Okay, so again, in these 1D models, we have a plateau that goes to fairly high pressures. In your models, I don't see this corresponding plateau.
Yeah, and so
I think it's perfectly reasonable. I just want to understand.
Right, yeah. This is a good question. Exactly what, and this is going back to this that Dong just brought up, is what exactly is going on in here, and how is this fully relaxed? Do we believe this? Emily and I were talking about this the other day. And what is the role in of this dynamics in influencing deeper down, where you're not actually seeing these high velocities? Like, you can get supersonic velocity. I don't think I have a plot here, but you get supersonic velocities, of course, up in this region, but they all go to zero when you get down here.
Well, so, I'm sure the plateau also depends on the difference between the opacity and what's going away. You get that plateau when the radiation coming in is seeing much less opacity. If your opacity happens to be similar, you
won't get that point. Right. Yeah. So you get this invert, but well, yes, you're right. Absolutely. But
what is the ratio this?
Well, so it's not a constant ratio, actually. So these opacities that I'm using are opacities that come from Sharp and Burrows. So it's wavelength dependent opacities that I basically made a huge table of. So this gamma factor varies, which is the ratio of the two opacities, varies as a function of position. I did a bunch of tests when I first made this, comparing to some of your models, and it seems to, you know, for a constant gamma factor, and it does, it seems to reproduce these.
I'm clarifying. Generally speaking, clarifying. Is the comparison between the two opacities to understand?
Right. So. It. Right. So it at the so this gamma factor for everyone else. Is like, it's defined differently, but it's K star, remember that's the absorption opacity, over K Planck. And some people put a quarter, you know, to the quarter, one quarter and whatnot. In fact, I think I do, so I'll go ahead and put that. So this is this gamma factor I keep talking about, and this is what controls, I was mentioning, this is what controls really the behavior in this first inversion up here. And so it's only when you can get an absorber that is actually opacity here that is lower than this, that you can, such that your photosphere can get deeper into the planet. So the optical photosphere is deeper in the planet than the infrared photosphere. It's only then when you can actually get this inversion. And so
maybe offline you can look at those numbers and give them.
Yeah, I believe it's about 0.1 for the upper atmosphere, but then of course it changes lower down.
I missed there. What are the two inversions?
So there's the claim here is that there's one inversion here. Which is
the curve goes up.
The curve goes up. So temperature increases as you move out. This is right. Kind of a typical stratosphere, like what you would call a stratosphere. And then the other inversion is instead of this being isothermal, or relatively isothermal, or increasing, continuing to increase down there, you actually get a dip here. So temperature, what I'm calling an inversion is temperature is increasing out as you move out in this region as well. So and that's due to the dynamics.
The signature of them being two separate inversions is that there's some inflection there.
Yes.
Okay. It is monotonic from that.
Yes, right. Up. But this, of course, is very, very dependent on what you choose for this, right? I mean, if you chose the function is a function of pressure, will determine the shape of this. So it's all very dependent on what you choose as your opacity.
So could this be a consistent interpretation of the opacity, which is you said that the optical is seen in somewhat less opacity than the infrared. So in the absence of the dynamics, you would see more of a plateau as having referred.
Yeah, and in fact, that's exactly what you see.
Destroyed by the, or at least disturbed by the hydrodynamic flows, hence your
hydrodynamic
inversion.
Absolutely, yeah.
And my question was, why is it destroyed all the way down?
Right.
Very, very high pressure.
Yeah. Why isn't it just stopping at this, say, this pressure where the flow goes to go?
Just to be clear, it's being driven by the energy dumped by the radiation.
The plateau that is the isothermal region deep in that.
Right. Yeah. Okay, I should keep going here. Okay, so I've run a series of different viscosities, and as mentioned, viscosity here is meant to represent some subgrid process that we don't understand, some Kelvin-Helmholtz instability, something there that is occurring that is tapping into the overall flow structure. So I've run for first of all for a range of opacities to motivate it physically. I'm not going to remember the numbers exactly off the top of my head, but there are numbers for the species diffusion in upper regions of Jupiter that Moses et al., I think, that put that at about 10 to the 8 centimeters a second. So this type of range might be reasonable. This is, in my opinion, most definitely not reasonable. This is way too high. But I put it in there just to highlight the transition from flow that's very axisymmetric, two jets remaining subsonic, so this is only 0.7 kilometers a second, to, you know, very axisymmetric flow, transitioning down to a jet-like flow at the equator.
Can you come back to the point that was raised earlier, which is how long have these been around? Have these relaxed? Should we be interpreting these as sort of steady-state structures?
So the way I typically tell if it's relaxed is, look at it over a period of, you know, a movie of some sort, but also monitor the total kinetic energy or total energies as a function of time, and you can see where they turn over and plateau. And these are all these are all steady state structure. That being said, there's going to be variation on top of this.
There's a standing shock right there.
Yeah, and so I mean, this is quite amazing if you think about this. This is two supersonic jets. This one's going 4 kilometers a second that way. This one's going 4 kilometers a second this way. They're shearing past each other. And then this guy here is actually subducting under the other one and shearing in that direction. I have a plot of that. I'm not going to say the numbers off the top of my head. So you can see that as the jet structure changes, of course, the efficiency of advection. So this is temperature now. You can see this is very sharp day-night temperature delineation. As the jet increases in magnitude, you get a larger kind of finger sticking over into the night side.
But this was when I asked about the vertical. If you go back to the field, when I asked about vertical velocities before. So you say that blob that's sticking out is subducted But you also told me that the vertical velocities were much less than the horizontal velocity. So I'm having difficulty how you come screaming in, then you go down slowly.
That's true. Yeah. There is substantial. There's the radial velocity, of course, at this in this location and over in this region here, is substantial.
Okay, so
of course. And there's also actually this. I don't have a plot of this, but it's this fabulous giant vortex that occurs right.
You pointed out, of course, as you're pointing out, that this is supersonic flow and it's transonic flow, and it's only a hydrodynamic and a compressible hydrodynamic code that can really properly address this. So when Emily talks, I mean, we'd like to make the comparison between an approach that can't handle this, an approach that does, and whether we need to go into that regime.
Yeah, and I'll show you if we get to it, some eccentric calculations, for example, but where the reestablishment of the jet structure occurs causes a huge amount of heating. So it's kind of difficult to see in some of these plots given the colors and whatnot, but there is shock heating in this region here that is comparable to the PDV work, for example. So so it can be quite important. So I just want to again touch on variability. So this particular simulation where you have this subducting eastward material subducting under westward material shows some variability, and so just to motivate it, there is some suggestions. And again, I'm not the observer. I'm not interpreting. I don't know. I'm not going to comment on how whether I observed this. I believe it or not. But there's suggestions that I believe it's this point here that this is a significant difference from one observation to the next. And then, so this is a dayside emission spectrum. This is not the planet I'm doing. This is 189733.
Clear, those black points are IRS spectral from Spitzer taken at a certain time, and the red points are IRAC photometric points taken at another time.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, not all. I understand that not all the authors of that paper interpret the differences as temporal.
Oh, that's good. That's good to know. Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess the point is not to say it's observed yet, but
there's one really secure observation of time variability. AC 80606.
Yeah. Oh wow. Yeah, there's a black.
Well, okay. It's there's true. A difference between an inherently time variable system, right? Hugely eccentric.
That's highly variable illumination.
Right. It should be variable.
Exactly.
These ones. Yeah. There may be probably a constant kind of illumination. And so the variability issue for 189, the 8-micron secondary eclipse has been observed a couple times, and it's like a 2.3 sigma difference kind of thing. And there's a couple other cases of kind of 2-ish sigma differences between things. Mark Swain will also talk about, if you ever talk to him about, and I think this is a paper coming out kind of soonish, maybe, that they have, I forget whether it's transmission or emitted spectrum, but they took three separate observations, and two of them are rather similar, and one of them is rather different.
So I'd say transmission.
Yeah, I think it's right.
And then maybe you're also going to talk about the.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say that this is a relatively newer paper that's come out there where they parameterized doing all the pressure-temperature profiles. But what they do is they try to fit a huge number of observations given a single pressure-temperature profile, or all the observations given.
Single class of pressure-temperature profiles with parameterizations.
Well, their claim is that they can't fit all the observations with a single kind of temperature structure.
You mean all the observations?
No, of a single object. Yeah, sorry. These are all 189. And the final thing, just to kind of on the no variability side, is the successive secondary eclipse measurements of, I think this is 209458. I'm sorry, I don't remember. Is it 189 as well? Okay. Anyway, they show that really that their claim is they don't see. This is by Agle et al. They don't see any variations. On the day side.
But importantly, there have to be temporal variations it's all a matter of magnitude and what it really depends on, but there have to be, as there are with the Earth, et cetera, things are varying.
Right, the question is, is it large enough to detect?
And the summary is, at the moment, there is a little mounting evidence that there might be variability, but at a 10% level or less, and
right.
It's difficult to measure.
Yes, that's fair.
But your simulation's way below 10, the steady state structure is way below 10%.
Well, I'll show you, hold on. Come on. Too far.
If you integrate over the disk,
Okay, so here are simulation snapshots of the simulation. So this is after it's kind of reached, this energy has plateaued, come to some sort of steady state, and then these are all separated by half a day. And you can see this structure where you have this. So this is temperature, and the contours are also temperature. You can see the structure where you have this jet coming in this way and this other jet coming back this way, and the two are that you can set up an kind of an undulation or wave between those two structures, and you also have the effect at depth. But you can see that as these jets flop around, you can see that I believe it's all on the same. I meant to put it all on the same temperature scale, but it's not quite. But you can see that the efficiency, or the advection of energy across changes, and you get different flow structures as a function of time. Now I'll get back to the more of a diagnostic of this in a minute, but just to again keep going here, to motivate it again, here's this shear I'm talking about. So I've taken cuts in latitude. So I'm taking cuts along here at the photosphere of velocity as a function of a function of latitude. So that's latitude here as a function of velocity. So it's plus or minus 4 kilometers a second. So this is a pretty amazing and very narrow cut in velocity. Now this is a picture of depth. And so here what I'm doing is I'm taking this region here in the equator and going down into here. And so here's the temperature. This is all, again, temperature, but it's contoured with velocity. And so you can see this jet is coming down here, and this jet is coming over the top. This is subducting under here. In this interaction, you're getting all kinds of potential vorticity generation. Vortexes form and merge, and that also plays a role in stirring these things up. So there's...
You could say the velocities.
What?
You could just say that plot like
with velocities? Sure.
One thing
you can
that
make that
crucial is to see where your convective zone is as a function of latitude and longitude.
Sure, but that's well below this, though.
But it would be nice to know, because the convective zone completely mixes the heat from the interior.
Yeah.
And it's going to come out differently in the day side and the night side, and it affects directly the evolution.
Yeah, that's always been a problem that I've been interested in.
Directly connected to the issue of explaining the giant planets.
Right. Is there any way, basically, to retard the contraction of the planet based on the dynamic?
They might contrast in the what happens at the radiative convective boundary is really rather crucial in this whole issue.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it'd be nice if you could extract that from your models.
Right, I think that would be.
Interpretation of this diagram suggests that the whole shown in the yield picture would appear somewhat difficult. If you're not having much penetration.
It doesn't go super deep.
I wasn't actually referring to that, but it was.
It doesn't go very deep. The shear doesn't go very deep, and so it becomes a problem if you want to use that shear to. I mean, you still need, just like tides, you need it to get it into the interior.
Well, can you later out offline plot the pressures of the radial convective boundary for the 4 Preister radians or almost 4 Preister radians or 3 Preister radians in your model?
Sure.
I'd like to see that.
Yeah. Sure.
Offline.
But sorry to be.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, maybe I can make that after you're done.
No, it's fine.
But there's a. So I don't know if maybe you show this figure, but looking at the wind speed is misleading. Even with weak wind speeds, deep down you have a lot of kinetic energy.
Yeah,
okay, you know, for that. So this is misleading. If you want to look at energy, you have to look
at energy.
Wind speed.
Okay.
But there's a lot of energy.
Fair enough.
In the atmosphere.
Yes, there is.
There's a lot of energy.
Yeah, right.
Energy density, maybe.
Yes. Is hot. Yeah.
Okay, so we should talk about it. We can make that. But
I didn't get to show that last time.
You mentioned these vortices?
Yeah.
I don't see it.
No, I don't, but you do a. I'll show it to you. It's another plot, but there's a very, it's a very big vortice, kind of whirlpool right in that corner. So,
but I do want to emphasize again, you're looking sometimes just the minutia. Some of the major issues are you're getting shocks, and that's dissipative, and that may be the dissipation mechanism that stops the winds from accelerating. You're
of course.
They're supersonic. Other people aren't saying that.
Well,
there may be
right.
other processes.
Yeah, no, no, of course. So that's, yeah, I mean, that's an obvious.
It's directly connected. This should be communicated.
Okay.
This is my point about the radiative convective boundary as a function of latitude and longitude.
Yeah.
And where that is really crucial. If it varies a lot, then that has a lot to say about this entire family of close in giant planets.
Yeah. Right. Well, I mean, that's something we should look at.
On that. A third thing is it would be nice to get a sense of what P sub n is or some estimate of that.
To parameterize it, yeah. People want to see other plots here. Okay, this is hemispheric. I'm going to skip this.
We're supposed to be interrupting, so I'm going
to
I'm going to skip this. This is basically I've done better now. This is transmission spectra. So I'm starting now to calculate real transmission spectra. So what I do is I shoot rays through the limbs of my planet. Of course, the pressure temperature profile varies because you're moving up and down as you go across the limb, but you're also varying because the pressure temperature profile varies. So you're actually calculating real transmission spectra for these things. So this is absorption depth as a function of lambda. These are opacities, again, from Sharp and Burrows. The blue points are the observed points from Mulot et al. 2009, which is shown down here. And these are various, this is the spectra that calculated, everything's been normalized to the 3.5 micron data point. And then all the solid circles, which I'm afraid it's hard to see, are the band averaged values for these things. So the idea here was to show how much variability in the transit spectra you would expect for those four shots of, if I can flip back there for a second, most of the variability here is actually occurring in the terminator. So that's great. So what kind of a variability would you expect? And unfortunately, from this full disk spectra, you're not seeing much. If you look just at the egress, and if, in fact, compare it to the ingress and the full disk spectra, you can start to see some variations here. And I'll leave it to other people to tell me whether or not those are observable. Probably not, but that's become somewhat interesting.
So just to understand, in the upper left plot, the different curves that are almost on top of one another are just at different times?
Yes, so they're separated by half a day.
Right, okay.
And this is the idea, is to see this see if we can see this variability. One thing to notice is that we're not hitting these points here. I'm not hitting these points here anywhere near them. And so I want to note that there are this model here uses a different. This is just water opacity, and it's a new set of lines. So maybe later Adam can tell us a little bit about the details about using this and that. I'm trying to work on getting these opacities and doing the same calculation. So these, according to Giovanni, who did the Giovanni Tonetti, who did these models, this new water was new water lines were crucial for hitting those points. But the point of this really was to see that the fact that there is some variability here, perhaps not observable at this moment. If you want to look at the differences in viscosity, you can do that too. Again, this is the whole disk, i.e. when it's right in the middle of transit. This is when it's in ingress and egress. And you can see a couple things. One, now we start to separate these are the different viscosities. So this is the lowest viscosity to the highest viscosity. And not only that, but you can really start to see a difference in the western and eastern transmission spectra. Okay, so I'm pretty much done, but I just want to flash up some things. Again, these are things that I've started, and I would love to talk to you guys about, and if you have other ideas, I'd be happy to pursue them. The first is eccentric planets, and so this is an example. All I've done here is I've taken 209458, that same model, and I put it on an eccentric orbit. I think this one is a 0.5 eccentricity. I kept the pericenter at 3.5, so it has the same rotation period. That was the idea. So the idea is that these are, so try to isolate what's going on here. And so this is just during, I haven't shifted this, but of course this is the cut of the photosphere. So it's fairly symmetric in the east, the northern and southern hemispheres. So I've just looked at the northern hemisphere here. So this is the equator running along here. The North Pole would be up this way. And then this is at depth. So these two plots kind of can be thought of as looking right angles to each other. So you're seeing what's happening at depth, and you're seeing what's happening at the photosphere. And what you're seeing here as the planet comes swings through periastron is that this heating pattern, again, is set up. And this huge, these winds are driven again back to the night side. And you're seeing a huge amount of heating at this day side where these two are meeting. So this is 27.1, this is 27.8. So it's very, very close. So this is just as it swings away from periastron. You can see that this plot isn't great, but you can see that the actual temperature at on the night side, or what will be the night side at that point, starts to become comparable, especially as you swing away and the radiation goes down.
Which part of this is the star at peri?
I haven't shifted. So just take the hottest spot. We can quantify that a little bit more exactly later. But the radiative timescale on that is pretty quick up in the very top there.
So you probably said this. The contour lines are showing
temperature,
and the color is showing velocity.
They're both. Oh, sorry, you're right. No, I mentioned here temperature and contours are velocity. Yeah, so this is the hot day side, colder night side, and then these are the velocity structures. And this is for the particular kind of intermediate viscosity case. So we could run these for other viscosities and so on and so forth. Talk a little bit more about this variability. There's this kind of mystery. I don't know if I put these fancy arrows. Hey, look at that. This puzzling fact that in the phase curve of 189733, the coldest spot and the hottest spot are in the same hemisphere, or they're less than 180 degrees apart. Which, to my knowledge, most models have extreme difficulty. In fact, I haven't really heard too much explanation. I will say that there were times, and this model needs to be run for more time to see whether or not this was a transient phenomena or not. But there was times that this, if you looked at the temperature as a function of time, or this as a function of time, that the cold shot, this coldest spot was shifted on this side of the variability.
They looked at this object at 24 microns and at 8 microns at different times, so they see the same
effect. They see the same effect. Okay, so it's maybe perhaps more of a steady state thing.
Well, but at 24 microns, when they say that actually, the 24 micron data are noisier, and they say that the minimum actually happens on the other side of
okay, I see.
Anyway,
the curves looking the same, but you're probably.
Very similar, but they say, okay, it's hard, right? Because you're actually observing the system for only half of the time, so you're not fully sampling the globe. So some parts are less well measured than others, and they say that
that's a good point.
Go from a light curve to a temperature map of the planet is slightly non-trivial. And they do an orange slice model where they say, let's consider, you know, 8 slices, 4 slices, this kind of thing, right? Each at a constant temperature. And so the paper where they're looking at both the 24 and the 8 micron data, at 24, in that paper they say, oh, well, actually, it's fairly consistent if we assume only 4 slices of having the coldest area on the other side transit.
Those slices are very interesting. It's an art or a science or a black art. But they were so, the picture of the distribution of temperature, in quotes, has so excited the Spitzer people that they're using that as a highlight to try to get more Spitzer.
Okay, let me quickly go through the rest.
More Spitzer going. So that is an iconic figure now.
Yeah.
There's this question, going back to the issue of the inversion, is like how well can you keep things up in the atmosphere? How well does vertical macroscopic mixing actually carry things up into the atmosphere? So Dave has this paper of this what parameterized mixing coefficient KZZ as a function, I think, of size of the particle, and then you look at basically what is the fraction of these absorbing molecules that you can keep up in the atmosphere, and this is particular one was TIO, and so this is again plays back into the issue is of whether or not this is whether or not the inversion is what we expect it to be, is you know, induced by some sort of extra absorber. And so in principle, I think that there must be a way to take the results that I have now and calculate some sort of mixing coefficient in some way. And so this is, of course, I don't think this is the answer, but what I've done is some sort of, you know, radial RMS velocity times some sort of scale height, and you come out with some KZZ as a function of pressure. So again, this is very all preliminary, just to spark discussions later.
Yeah, scale height is too big.
Right, I agree. Very recently, I've now done, I don't know if you, I didn't highlight it, unfair on my part, but I had a cutoff, an upper boundary to my pole. And so I've now gotten rid of that to some most extent. What I've done is I've made the top polar region one large grid cell. And so the extent of that grid cell can, of course, be whatever you want it to be, but at this point in these models, it's about 7 degrees across. And what you see is these models are actually currently running right now, and they haven't reached that plateau. But as far as these plots, it looks somewhat similar so far. You still have this subducting jet coming. So this is velocity. This is temperature. You still have this subducting flow, and then these two jets that come. This is speed actually. So it doesn't have any. This is just total velocity. It doesn't have any directional component to it. So you still have the structure at the equator seems to be fairly similar. It may be a little cooler at the, as to be expected, a little cooler near the poles than previous. I've got emission spectra now, which are quite interesting. So this is emission spectra as a function of wavelength for different phases. So this would be the dayside phase, moving around to the night side and then back to the dayside as the planet is showing you different faces. And you can see, obviously, that's quite different. So, and then finally, to get back to this idea of the convective radiative boundary. Sorry, I'm going way over time. In this region here, of course, you're eventually going to join onto the central adiabat. And in some of the models, I have convect and some don't. In this particular model, you can see that. So this is like a perturbation density on top of the background. So this is the azimuthal direction. So this is around the equator. And this is radius. And so you can see this this convective structure that is occurring deep in the atmosphere. And so really understanding the role, the influence of this on the rest of the stuff up in the atmosphere, what we're observing, is very interesting.
Maybe you can plot that versus pressure.
Absolutely, yeah. Gotcha. So I'll leave it at that. Sorry, I've gone over. There's lots of, I guess, what I'd love you guys to concentrate is down there at the bottom, thinking about other projects. So yeah, anyway, sorry to go over.
I just want to emphasize that you really can't go over in these talks. You're guided by the numbers we may give, but
good. Okay.
The thing is to have the information exchange. You might go over perhaps because of interruptions, and those interruptions are encouraged.
Hey, wait, no, I just want to hear about it.
So we give you guidance on the time. You
okay.
Go over, but sure. Try to follow it. If you don't, that's fine. Anyway, more questions.
Regarding eccentricity, I mean, these hydrosimulations must be computationally quite expensive. But are we getting close to the point where you can actually maybe model not just a non-zero E, but an E dot or an A dot? So not knowing.
1,000 days is about the best you're going to get. Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately. I mean, you could do a series of simulations, but you're not going to do any kind of.
Right, right. The time scales would just be too long. I was just wondering. Well, yeah. Because, I mean, just to model the possible type 1 migration, for example, into.
But that's a small. So, to a good extent, you would say the atmosphere equilibrates to its current.
I think it's here,
forcing, and then you change the forcing. So, the things are quite distinct.
Yeah. That's why I say you could do a series of simulations.
That's an interesting question. To generally understand the function of location and the nature of the forcing that might happen, but it's usually going to be.
It'd be wonderful to know what happens as you change the semi-major axis.
Yeah, absolutely, of course.
Even the gravity would be interesting. Metallicity.
There are so many parameters that go into this, but all of which need to be very. Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
So we talked a little bit about tracking the Lagrangian fluid elements.
Yeah.
The other day, you had a figure of potential vorticity, did you?
I don't think I ever showed that, but.
Oh, maybe you mentioned it.
Yeah.
But we didn't think to there's going to be another interesting quantity to see what happens to it as you follow a fluid element. Is it conserved, for example?
No. It doesn't have to be in these codes. You can generate potential vorticity. And yeah, and those shocks, of course, you're generating potential vorticity. So I have looked at that. We can make a plot if you'd like. I think that actually Emily solves the whole equation, all the equations in potential vorticity space. So I mean, you can look at maybe she'll have some plots of it. I don't know.
So you don't have convective flux in the equation, but I guess it's effectively captured in the PDE.
Yeah. So this is another issue with the convection is that
you're hoping to capture.
My bottom boundary condition. What I do is I actually hold the radial flux such that it's high enough that it will instigate convection in the few cells right above that.
What's your bottom boundary condition? Velocity goes to zero.
Yeah, and there are better prescriptions out there for a boundary condition that's actually in a convection zone, and that could be something we could. If it's
also,
important to
velocity will be different in the convection zone than the radial zone.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And so this was just the first. What happens to the velocity of viscosity in the overall upper atmospheric flow. But yes, you're right. Very specific functional dependence of viscosity will matter. So.
It's like there's a clean separation between the convective region and the atmospheric dynamics. Is that something you expect to apply in general?
I think so. I think there is. But I didn't get into this, but if you look at...
Is there a clean separation between the convective
Yeah, I think that in general there is, and I didn't actually add this, but if you start looking at waves that are traveling through this atmosphere, the convection is stirring up waves that perhaps can transfer angular momentum throughout the atmosphere to the upper regions. But for the most part, I think you're at least a first order that. For sure, they're separated.
And does that mean that your convective radial interface is spherical?
I think it will end up being spherical, but I need to go. Yeah, I think we should go back and think about it.
I think it's a difficult question. Actually, what Adam is saying is that if you do a model of the day side, you have some location. If you do a model of mass side, you have another location in pressure. And then what happens will matter on exactly this issue of interaction and the relative convective boundary. In 3D, so I don't think we know.
And also the other thing I'll add is that of course these are for 4 giga-year planets, right? And so for the younger planets, the ratio of interior flux to exterior flux is higher, and so you'll then become important for younger.
So given that you've done so much, quite impressive. So if I assume it's not that big deal to add a time-dependent forcing, like tidal forcing.
No, it's in. I mean, I actually have it. I have it in. It's not turned on. I was trying to understand one hand one thing. No, it's debugged. It's debugged. No, but I just there's so many parameters you can vary here that.
What do you mean time-dependent forcing?
Wait. What do you mean with tidal forcing? There is time-dependent relative forcing.
The gravitational forcing as well.
It's not synchronized, but you just add a external tidal forces.
Especially for the eccentric orbits.
How do you want to put that? You have this
in this force equation.
Just in the gravity.
Yeah,
the effect of gravity is going to be different.
Yeah.
Throughout the orbit.
You already have all this thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's something else that would be something interesting to think about.
So I'm confused about exactly.
No, we have everything. You can
drive waves. I can see that in the fluid. But this is, I don't understand where you...
The pressure scale height will change.
Just put the tidal effect.
Just the tidal force.
You mean the tidal deformation?
Sorry?
The tidal deformation and the
tidal. No, just add your force equation motion. Just add a...
It's not working.
So yes, it's the same sort of thing.
So you're saying energy from tidal deformation.
Just this will vary as a function of time, is what he's saying.
Yeah. Very a function of angle.
And angle as well. But and time as well.
It may be difficult with the computational grid.
Admit it.
You'll get this tidal bulge and that having that going in and out of the
inner boundary.
Right.
There's a number of issues there. So one is that this is the self gravity of the object. The sure. Meteorological equation, you solve this equation. I don't know what you do. The meteor equation, you solve this equation on geopotential. So that includes the rotational deformation of the planet.
Right.
I don't know where you have
this.
At the equilibrium time, and then on top of that, you can drive waves.
Yeah.
How do you do that? content is not obvious.
But in the hydro context, it is pretty obvious, except
in this equation,
except as Gordon points out, you might have to go all the way to the center of the object to include the proper deformation.
Actually, I understand.
Include the proper deformation in another way, so that the inner boundary is properly deformed.
It's not easy to do well.
On a related question, can you address this, can you settle the this backyard fight that seemed to have grown up in Princeton about thermal thermites?
Yes.
Your postdocs and your faculty are not talking to each other except the literature.
I think they're talking to one another.
On the archive.
It's very simple. It's very simple. Gordon may have something to say about this too.
So short answer to this is Jeremy Goodman has in his hands MBD's model to calculate the thermal types. Jeremy Goodman, who has been working on it, has the model that MBD will show you, he's calculating the thermal types in that model.
I've got it's another project I didn't include here, but I do have a series of simulations that are at a fixed orbit, you know, not zero eccentricity, but non-synchronous, and you can see these waves that are generated. I haven't had time to. It's a different approach. Yeah, it's a very complementary approach, I think. So.
I will suggest that the viscosity you're using, which of course is not the same as K sub ZZ. K sub ZZ is.
Oh, sure, sure. Right, of course.
The same units, but.
Yeah.
I would like to get a better handle on that because I would think that setting it equal to a small number would be perfectly sensible.
Okay. That's fine. And, yeah, I mean, and that's simulations
well,
eventually.
In the convection zone. You don't want to make it in the convection zone.
Yeah, but he can't resolve that anyway. So he's going to have convection. He's not going to be able to have resolve the right. He can't do the right Reynolds number regime anyway. Nobody's going to be able to use that. So I think it's a moot point. Anyway,
yeah.
Varying the viscosities you see makes a huge difference.
Yeah, absolutely. Right.
I think that you're going to be in one extreme or another.
Well, yeah, so I think that from that you should believe the low-end viscosity case.
So I think that would be sensible. So yeah. The question is, how are you handling shocks? We've talked about that over the
Yeah, so there's, I actually, since we talked about this almost a year ago now, and since then I have put, in addition to the advection scheme, artificial viscosity in the Zeus method of putting that in. The terms that turn on, well, we can get into that detail later. Okay. But
it's like a Rick Meyer Morgan artificial viscosity.
Yeah. Right.
Things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm not claiming that the shocks are resolved, but I do think that energy is being dissipated in that general area.
Okay. But one thing that would be useful when you're writing up the papers and maybe have an appendix on test problems.
Yeah, like right. I have a whole bunch of I have a bunch of those.
And
I thought about that.
The shocks.
Yeah. The paper was long enough as it was. Okay. So, yeah. Anything else?
That KZZ, was that something you were measuring from the simulation, or something you were putting in?
No, I was trying to, the idea was that, in principle, I should be able to measure it from the simulation to use as a feedback for the one-dimensional calculation. So all I did was I said, what is the RMS over some period of time radial velocity? And then I tried to, it was just purely dimensional, you know, multiply at times some scale height, which, as Adam says, is probably too large. Maybe I should use a radial velocity scale height. That one was particular, a pressure scale height.
I think the scale height is too large for the Earth's atmosphere, for example. The scale height, pressure scale height is 8.5 kilometers. And you know that the scale on which we have mixing in the atmosphere is tens of meters. So it's very different scale.
Close to the surface.
Right. So I will say also, though, that there is this large scale upwelling that is occurring. So.
You can't model with a nice diffusion as we
Yeah, exactly. So that may.
Of course, is in Dave's paper, is that we want to be able. Some people would want that diffusion to be large, so that you could loft it for
example,
TIO or VO.
High end of the atmosphere.
Depth to altitude.
Yeah.
I think that you can't do that.
Right.
That's an open question.
But I mean, the KZZs that I was.
Large, then it's in principle possible.
Right.
It might explain via absorption of the stellar flux. The inversions that we're inferring
right.
For a number of these secondary eclipse.
Yeah, places. Right, of course. So, I mean, so the idea, I guess, is how should we go about calculating this? You know, obviously, this first approach or first stab is not correct, but.
No, I didn't understand how you're measuring the diffusivity. I mean, these are quite large scale flows, which are significant quantities around. What
right.
Is that describable as
I don't think it, I don't, perhaps, I mean, you're right, perhaps that's not the correct thing. With this large scale upwelling, a diffusivity is not the right way to think about it. But I think that's what one-dimensional codes, some sort of one-dimensional codes need. And so that's what that was the idea, because I can't follow all the chemistry and whatnot. And so
in principle, if you need resolution, you can do better than the simple analytic models that Dave and I put together to try to address the same issues.
Yeah.
So you would think that if you have that much mixing vertically of tracers, you would have that much viscosity of mixing of momentum.
And that's where I was getting back to the issue about Jupiter trying to constrain that viscosity.
You don't want to double count.
So,
yeah.
So
that's a good
little
point.
Bit of figuring out to what extent that's gonna remove, well, at least for large numbers.
The viscosity.
Even in your low viscosity.
Yeah.
But there would be, if it's turbulent or if it's effective, let's describe it as turbulent, that would also mix momentum. So that would effectively be reducing the vertical shear.
Yes.
So I guess you would claim that's captured also in your simulation. You do have this
vertical shear, and I would think so, but again, not with the correct viscosity, but yeah.
Yeah, the only relevance for the viscosity would be on the subgrid scale or molecular. Molecular is probably really too small.
No, I think that this is, that this is...
There
this
could
is,
be something, that's true.
Yeah, it could be very small.
There are other processes,
on your grid, eventually.
I mean, there are other processes, fluid dynamic processes.
Viscosity, that's just... The fluctuations, correlations, etc., in the flow. But somebody who didn't have that resolution, even above your resolution, would have to model as a diffusion,
as
or some sort of viscosity.
Yeah.
People for the Earth, they knew that they could actually a finite amount of vertical mixing.
Sure.
In the model.
In the GCM. No.
In the GCM.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
But it's not. So. Okay.